Hey A1 fans, Andy here. We're going to Cisco Live and we can't wait to see you there. If we see you wearing an A1 or Cables to Cloud shirt at Cisco Live, we'll enter you in our giveaway that includes a bunch of cool prizes like an A1 branded Yeti cup and an OCG of your choice from our friends at Cisco Press. Don't have a shirt? No problem. Head to the link in our bio and grab yours today. See you soon.
This is the Art of Network Engineering podcast. In this podcast, we explore tools, technologies, and talented people. We aim to bring you information that will expand your skill sets and toolbox and share the stories of fellow network engineers.
Welcome to the Art of Network Engineering. I am AJ Murray, and we are back for another exciting episode. Joining me this evening is Andy. He is at Andy Laptef on Twitter and other social media platforms. Andy, how are you? It's good to see you.
Hey, AJ. Good to see you, buddy. I am well. What am I doing? I just published another piece of content for my employer, which always makes me happy that I get to... create content and have that.
Is it anything public? Can we direct
the... It is public. There will be something coming out around design my employer is putting out. So yeah, that's exciting. Man. So I'm getting to do some fun stuff at work. I won't talk about seasonal stuff because this, God knows when this will come out. It might be this summer and I'll be talking about the impending fall. So yeah, man, things are good. I'll give a free shout out to the USNUA. I went to the PA network user group first, inaugural meeting, and it was really nice. I got to meet Drew Conroy Murray from Packer Pushers,
I saw that.
I was like fanboying, like, whoa, man. It was nice to get together in person with other network folks and just talk shop and what's going on in the industry. And I'm grateful that I'm remote and have been remote for 4 or 5 years, but yeah. I also really, really enjoy being in person, with people in tech. So that was really nice, man. How you doing? What's going on with
you? Doing well. I want to extend the shout out to the USNUA. So for our listeners, if you don't know, the USNUA is the US Network User Association, and they help form network user groups or NUGs throughout the country. And it's just a bunch of network engineering nerds getting together, talking, usually enjoying some free drinks and food. I myself have our next meeting coming up next week. It'll be the first week in November. And we're looking forward to it. We've already got just about 40 people registered, so it should be a good size meeting. And we got some great panelists lined up. We got some good topics that we're going to talk about. And it's just fun to do these local events, right? It sounds like you had a great time there at the PA NUG, and I'm looking forward to doing my second NUG and, getting these people together. It's a time to solve problems, right? Like everyone's just like, hey, I'm facing this. Like, how do you deal with that? And, we have this problem. And, it's really cool to see and participate in.
Yeah. And one of the reasons I love the show is we got to interview Jason Gintert, co-founder of the USNUA on episode 116. So just the cool people that I get to meet here, which then, months later become this event that I'm at that just, I don't know. I love what we do here. And we have a very cool guest tonight.
Yes. Andy, why don't you introduce him?
So my good friend and colleague, Sean Legan, also guest on the show previously. Don't remember the episode. I don't have it in front of me, Sean. But Sean, is an avid listener to our show. And at one point he came to me and, he's never done this before. So that's telling. But he's like, dude, I have the perfect guest for you. You have to have Doug Midori on the show. I'm like, all right, man. I trust Sean. He's a smart dude. He knows what he's talking about. And I started looking up Doug and I'm like, oh my God. We have to have Doug Midori on the show. So joining us tonight is Doug Midori. He's been described as the man who sees the internet. What's up, Doug?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for coming on. Where do you work, Doug?
I live with Kentik.
Kentik, yes.
So you work with our friend Phil.
Yeah. Working there every day.
So Doug, to kind of start out and kind of level set, can you give us the brief on your career? I mean, so today you see the internet and we're going to dive into what exactly that means. But you obviously have a relationship with networking. So what kind of got you into networking and how is it that you have come to see the internet the way that you do today?
Okay, let's see where to begin. So I got my undergrad at the University of Virginia. I got a degree in electrical engineering, computer engineering, and I attended school on a Air Force ROTC scholarship to pay for school. We didn't have money. My first job out of school and in the military was as a network engineer at a base in San Antonio, Texas. And I would say that's probably where I really learned. I mean, I had a lot of computer science classes in school. I think I had one networking class. I don't think I knew it that much out of my undergrad. And the group I was with, we had a Cisco network. It was very, even though it was in the military, it was very similar to what a networking IT shop would look like and be doing. So we had a lot of money for training. So they would send me the 1 week Cisco classes, did my certifications. And then after about a year of handling, Catalyst, 6500s and stuff, there was another group that did Unix administration, and among the officers, so I was an officer, a communications officer, the officers that were there, nobody wanted to deal with Unix. They were like, ooh, like, I don't want to, that's weird stuff. And I was like, I would love to do that. And they're like, really? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, really? Now you're in charge then. So anyway, I got to do that. Yeah, that was probably my first introduction where, and I really liked the Cisco academic process. I thought it was really well written. I learned really very, very quickly. If you could apply yourself, you could pick it up pretty quick. And I still probably draw on that knowledge, some of those things now. But
that was in the military? You were in the Air Force?
I was in the Air Force, yeah.
So I don't know if you can answer this without, killing me, but like what kind of networks are you managing in the Air Force? I mean, are you on a campus kind of stuff?
Yeah, that one is more just a campus. So I was with the Information Warfare Center in San Antonio, although it's changed its name maybe six times between when I was there and now. I don't know what it's called now. But it was a intelligence unit, and like the AFCERT, the Air Force CERT was attached to it, and there were people who were doing information operations, and then we were actually just responsible for the networking itself that enabled that. Analogous to a networking group, but yeah, it was a campus, I was doing everything. I was pulling fiber through ceilings and installing equipment. So it was a great place to learn. There were some other smart people in our group. And I also learned just the value of having a team, when you're in that kind of environment where you've got a bunch of smart people you're working with, and how much faster you learn when you've got good, smart colleagues that are motivated. And that's just you can't put a price on that, of just how, like, it's no class. There's no book you can read. There's no class you can take. That's the same as having to do the work and having good colleagues that you can learn from.
I feel like outages would be super stressful in like a military environment. Like you said something about warfare. Like I figure there's pretty critical services, or at least
communications happening. I think you learn early in that environment. I mean, beginning in 1999, so there were still operations in the Balkans going that were there was some criticality to it, of we had flights going over mapping out the like radar jamming stuff. They would come back, they'd figure out the signature and change the way that we do our jamming of their jamming and stuff. Anyway, so can't go down. Those kind of things went down. Other things can, and you just learn. And then, my second job was, I did a good job in the first assignment, the first 2 years in San Antonio, and then they kind of rewarded me with this command position that I was maybe too young to have, but I made it work. And then for the next 3 years, I was a flight commander in Aviano Air Base in Italy, on a unit that did deployable radar and air control. So basically we had guys sitting in front of scopes talking to pilots, talking the military of pilots through their missions. And then we had radar, like fold up radar that you could like put on the back of a truck, but still had 300 mile radius vantage, just like far greater than anything you get like ATC. And so there's a lot of communications needs of the operators, which are the guys in front of the scopes, talking to the pilots, talking to ATC, talking to other radar units. And yeah, in that case, communications are pretty critical. We would have a satellite link out as our main connection to our deployed site. The whole thing had to be able to be packed up and deployed somewhere in 24 hours. And that's like 100 people. So this is like not a small thing. It's something we just have to practice all the time. We practice, even to ourselves, we would give ourselves, a no notice thing and just call everybody at 3 a.m. and be like, everybody come in and we're packing up and you don't know if this is real or not. So come in and then midway through the day, you're like, this isn't real. but here's your grade on how well you came in the middle of the night to come start packing up. So as a officer in that squadron, I think I got good at trying to anticipate how things are going to go wrong, as we plan out either our exercises or ultimately, our deployment to Iraq, which, I think, so Sean, you mentioned Sean, he was one of my airmen at the time. And it's probably 20 years ago, might be today. I don't know what the day was that we went, but, we ultimately went, to Iraq in the first year of the war.
And, was it still a networking job? Cause it seems like it changed.
Yeah. So the first job was very technical and it was again, analogous. If I wasn't wearing a uniform, it would be really similar to what, sysadmin IT or network admin, very little was, I think, different, to be honest. The second job was completely different. It was like being in the army. And as an officer in charge of 55 enlisted, I'm not on equipment anymore. So this is not a technical role anymore. Right, even though I was designated as the squadron engineer of our squadron of whatever 260 people, I was the one person with an engineering background. I mean, I didn't do a lot of engineering. I needed to understand what all the guys under me, all the equipment, what it did and, you know, conceptually, but they were the ones like Sean would be the ones who would be on, going to the training, be on equipment, bringing up circuits and, making sure we have all the comm we need so we can.
Do you feel like the military set you up for, you know, some people I've talked to in the military, they're like, God, I got out and I just felt so, it was so hard to transition to civilian life and they didn't feel prepared. But it, to me, from where I'm standing, it seems like you had some really useful, awesome experiences in the military that would.
It was a positive experience for me. Yeah. I mean, there was certainly challenges. I mean, honestly, that transition from being a technical person sitting in a cubicle, you know, doing network admin, sysadmin stuff. The next thing I'm standing in front of 55 enlisted guys that, those folks mostly are people who are, they get kind of coded that they're always going to be these deployable people. So these are like, a lot of these guys had seen everything. These guys have been everywhere. And who is this 24-year-old snot-nosed kid who's just like, yeah, he's got a CCNA. Who cares? Like a bunch of us have been to war. Like, who cares? So, that was a tough transition. I would say the first 6 months was pretty uncomfortable, to be very frank. And, I wanted out, I wanted to transfer, to join the comm squadron at the base, which that's another place where an comm officer might be. And then they do the more, we call it fixed comm, the basic network admin, sysadmin stuff. Again, very equivalent to, civilian stuff. I tried many times to transfer out. I always got, nixed. And after a while, I kind of accepted my fate that, this is where I belonged. And, in the end, you know, like I, by the time, Sean and I were going to Iraq in the fall of 2003, I was probably one of the most experienced officers for the type of role that I do. So it was probably fortuitous that, you know, it was probably good for everybody that I was still in that role. I had been doing it for a couple of years because that was going to be a tough job. And we had a very tough assignment that we had to handle and we pulled it off flawlessly, which was pretty cool. But, anyway, it all worked out, but yeah, you mentioned like, transition. I think I draw on it all the time and it was positive for me.
That's awesome. I guess at this point in your career, you still couldn't see the internet, right?
No. I mean, I knew BGP just from textbooks or getting into technical discussions with like sometimes we would be in a remote site bringing up a circuit and occasionally they would be in another like a BGP announcement. We would have a route that they would have to enter into the table to handle our remote site. And so if you follow like I don't know who does this besides me, but like if you follow the routes you're going through, like AS721, that's all the DoD stuff. You see routes coming and going. You don't know which they are. Well, sometimes these are deployed sites coming online and going offline, or ships. It shows up occasionally in BGP. That I had a little taste of it, but it wasn't until Renesis where I was just doing this all day long, every day. And I don't know that there's a lot of people on planet Earth that have done that for as long as I have.
So did you just stumble into Renesis? I mean, how, because you know, the rest of this conversation is probably going to be how you see the internet and all the insight and all this cool stuff. So like, when you say, you know, the DOD, you know, AS and stuff coming up, I'm like, wait, I've worked in BGP. I've never even, so I can't wait to dig into that stuff. But how did Renesis happen? Was that just a gig? And
yeah, so I, after Aviano, I had to make a decision. I was doing very well in the Air Force, but I was going to be moving up management wise. And I had to make a decision just career wise. Do I want to be more technical or do I want to continue this path? And, I liked the idea. It wasn't really about the money. I kind of, I thought that I'd be happier, doing some more technical stuff. To be honest, we were in Iraq in the first year of the war. I wasn't thrilled about that. More on a political, perspective that I just didn't think this is what we should be doing. And, that was a factor anyway. So then I was like, all right, well, I'd like to go to graduate school somewhere. We get back into having spent 3 years in a management kind of position, try to get more into back into the technical space. So I went to graduate school at Dartmouth College, and I live in the town next to Dartmouth College. I've been there ever since. So I just wrote out emails to professors and tried to see if anybody would look at my background and find me interesting. I had gotten that advice from the U.S. Air Force Academy, who at one point was courting me to be a lecturer there. There was a way that you could get picked up to be a lecturer at the Air Force Academy, and then they would pay you to send you to civilian graduate school, which I was determined to go to. I started down that path. In the end, they kind of backed out unless I was going to commit to a PhD. And then at the same time, I got an offer from Dartmouth to come, and they were going to pay all my bills and pay me a stipend to be a student. And I was like, gosh, like I think I got to take that and move on. The way I got to Renesis though was, I worked a little while as a defense contractor. I wasn't super happy there. I worked healthcare IT security, and that didn't, it didn't quite fit. And then my advisor at Dartmouth was socially friends with one of the founders of Renesis, and I'd see this guy at parties and stuff. When I was deciding I was going to leave the hospital, I was like, all right, well, who do I know? Like, let me write to this guy. And I was like, hey, I hadn't really taken it very seriously. I think a couple of times, I think in the past, he had tried to recruit me, and I didn't, I should have taken him up on it, but, it all worked out. And so Renesis, for those of you who don't know, that was a company that did, we sold a BGP alarm, BGP monitoring, probably one of the first companies. In fact, I think that there's a patent out there that, they had made the first patent. The patent's so broad, I'm sure it's completely unenforceable, but you know, when there's a new technology, you don't know the whole space, there's a patent that just covers the whole space. I'm sure, like I said, it's not enforceable anymore. It's probably, on a big pile of patents owned by Oracle now. But, so I joined, Renesis, happy to do, something different. And they wanted somebody who would do all the things that the current crew didn't want to do, which was, data QA. So trying to figure out like, where are our, we were doing all this, BGP processing, classification of stuff, but it would make errors, and it was tedious to go look at them and figure out what's going wrong, how are we getting geolocation wrong, how are we doing relationship classification wrong, and then also report writing. Occasionally, we would have someone who's paying us a bunch of money want to go dig into some sort of problem and write up a report. And yeah, these were software guys, and they're like, "I don't want to write a report." And so I was like, "I'll do it. I'll do it." I don't. At the time, I wasn't like super into writing, but I was like, "I'm happy to give it a shot." And anyway, so I got it, but I got into it. Doing the data QA stuff, I still feel like that's a great way to learn a space. It's just live in the data and just really get into it. So I kept asking the guys that were there, like, you know, teach me what's, how do I properly interpret this, and where are the errors? And then what I ended up finding was that at the same time I'm finding errors, I'm also finding like really novel stuff that's interesting, and actually the same, you know, techniques uncover the same thing. So you may make some discovery of something that's pretty cool, or you find the bug and you got to go fix it. Well, either way is success. And so I started to kind of figure that out. And then Jim Cowie was one of the founders, and he was probably the more the guy who had a more of a public profile. He would write blogs. He was on the PC of many of the Nogs, Nanog, many of the Enog, Meenog. He would do a lot of presentations, and I started to kind of become an understudy for him and help him write some of the stuff. Some of the blogs and presentations, you know, at a certain point were, it's a big mix of my stuff and his stuff. We're kind of working together on that. And then at some point, he became very, like during the Arab Spring, when we were getting quoted for a lot of stuff, he was very gracious to share some of the limelight with me. And I always say that, you know, had he not done that, he had developed these contacts with the media. He had developed this process of wading into geopolitical stuff. If he kept that all to himself, I never would have held it against him. It was his company. He had done it all. So it's a credit to his character to say, like, well, here's a new guy who's smart. He's doing some good work. Let's have two people who can write and talk to the press and go to conferences. And at some point, he wanted to go start another company. He's just a intensely intellectually curious person who can't sit still. And, he wanted to go on and do something else. And so that all got transitioned over to me. And then I had the benefit of, you know, he was also the founder of the company, running a company, going to board meetings, doing all kinds of things that I didn't have to do. So when that got transferred to me, I could just do this full time. So I'm doing, diving into these outages. You mentioned like seeing the internet. This is when I got that, you know, moniker from the Washington Post. We were just writing. We could see so many things, and there was nobody else reporting on these at the time, or not that much. And once we kind of got the formula down, I kind of was like, well, I don't know how long this is going to last, so I want to just get everyone, like every, like a BGP leak, a BGP hijack, internet shutdown, if we've got the data, I want to see if we can catch everything and capture the value as far as like telling the world about these things.
Were customers asking for internet analysis? Because I want to frame this conversation. Like, my relationship with BGP in my technical career has just been either look at a BGP table and see if our routes are there. You can look in a looking glass, whatever. Or, my company has this application we're going to host. I have to advertise the /24 out to the world so people can reach it, right? And that's it. But
yeah,
you're talking about all this insight and geolocation. Like, I've looked in a BGP table and I wouldn't even know where's geolocation in there. So, you know, what is this analysis you were doing? What are customers asking for? Like, what do they want to know?
Yeah. So I guess, on the geolocation thing, so we would sell products so that someone could go and pull up country X, figure out who are the transit providers operating in this country, who are their customers. It was basically competitive business intelligence, and we would try to go around the world selling that as a subscription. But then that needed to have the geolocation correct, so that if you don't, and geolocation is a notoriously difficult thing, then you would, the product is wrong, and we would get complaints. So, but you know, having worked on that, that's what put us in a position when the Arab Spring started and Egypt went offline. We had already ironed that out. We know who the providers are. We know, you know, all the routes. We can pull up in a second what is Egypt at any given second based on our tracking of BGP, and then that helped enable us to tell the story because in that case it was very much visible in BGP. As far as like customers, I don't know. I think we would publish a lot of stuff about BGP, so we attract questions of people with. A question that I've gotten a couple times over the years that I think is a good use case for some of the techniques I've been developing is, you have a BGP-based DDoS mitigation. So like Prolexic kind of invented this a DDoS mitigation that firm is going to announce your address space. There's ways this can go wrong. And I don't think this is well understood. It would be something I would like to, if we can fully field some of these features I've been working on with Kentik. I'd like to really explore this topic because what ends up happening is normally you're a company announcing routes to the internet. You have an upstream, at least one. And so you want to have a DDoS mitigation vendor step in the way of an attack. And so they're going to announce your address space. Okay. So there has to be some sort of transition between you announcing these routes and that guy announcing the routes. And how that gets done, there's a few different techniques people use, but there's ways it can go wrong. You've got three parties. You've got your network, the vendor, and then your upstream, maybe upstreams. And so that transition isn't always perfect. And so we would get people that were pretty big firms with money, and they feel like they're paying a lot of money to a mitigation vendor and feeling like they're not getting the protection in a timely manner and they feel like they can't get in, they don't know themselves what's going wrong. They're not getting information from the vendor and they think maybe it's a BGP thing. Could we look at that? And sure enough, we'd look and we'd be like, yeah, if you look at the propagation through time, you can see, I can see when it begins, but when that mitigation firm, when their routes fully propagate, if it takes 20 minutes, that's not good. That means until it becomes 100%, you're not getting complete coverage. And so that transition time becomes important. And I don't think, even today, I don't think that's so well. I don't know. I like to visualize this. And most of them are fine. But occasionally you'll see a goof up where the upstreams continue announcing, the mitigation firm starts announcing, and now there's contention between the old way and the new way, and so the DDoS traffic is still coming through because the two are kind of fighting within BGP land. Anyway, so that is a scenario that is worth digging into.
Where are you getting your analysis? Like, is this magical software you wrote? Like, again, I keep going back to, like, I've seen BGP route tables and looking glasses. Like, I don't see any meaning there, right? Besides there.
Yeah.
It all
so we,
and
we
works.
Used to, so Renesas had built their own, BGP collection platform, I think around the same time that Rype started, and ours was even bigger, partly because we like actively would recruit people to, give us, always had to be full tables. And we would be, selling, services in like the Middle East or South Asia or places that are off the beaten path, whereas some of the public resources were very heavy towards academic networks, and which are maybe a little less interesting for the operational internet. So at those times, we would collect their data. Now,
when you say their data, I'm sorry to interrupt you. It's just prefix and the AS path.
Let me explain that. So the way it works for route collection is that you would configure yourself as if you were a customer. So we would have these, we have this custom software. This is Renesas. Nowadays, our people use like Quagga or something to replicate the behavior of a router. But the purpose is you would peer with them, ask them to configure you as a as if you were a transit customer, meaning that now you're going to get a view of their full table, at least the selected routes of their full table. And so then you can just start recording as you get the announcements. As you set up that session, you'll get a big push of data, you get a full, you'll now have the full table. And then as the announcements come in, you can just log those announcements, which can be a lot if you're pulling in all the announcements from the internet off that one session. So if you look at like Route Views out of the University of Oregon is a great public repository for BGP data. So they have collection points, basically software, same idea. They will peer via BGP with an entity, get configured as a customer. So they get a full table, that they can see and record. And so then you have all these different vantage points, that each one has got a full table. And with that, when you merge hundreds of these, vantage points together, then you've got the chance to try to understand, well, could I understand how does a route get propagated through the internet writ large, not just to one, AS, but like how is this getting propagated, through time? So that's kind of the data collection process. And so some of that happens now, like Route Views, Ripe Riz, are the two big public repositories of BGP data. Kentik, we have our own sessions to operate the Kentik platform. You have to peer with us because we use the BGP data to decorate or annotate the NetFlow as it gets pulled in. So we need a session there to annotate with the full AS path from the perspective of that router, the AS path of the source and destination IPs of every flow record.
We're also collecting flows.
Kentik is, yeah. I mean, that's our main product. Flow data. Flow. Yeah.
It's amazing.
I'm
still trying to get my head around. I'm not the smartest tool in the shed, I guess. So you mentioned the Arab Springs and, you know, that was like an uprising in Egypt, right? And something awful happened. And then Egypt eventually shut the internet down. I believe that's very high level,
that works
somewhat accurate. I mean, we could talk for an hour about what happened, right? But so how did you know, if I look at the BGP route table, like how do I know that that's Egypt's AS and that their government shut it down? Like I still can't get my head around how you're extracting meaning from route tables.
Sure. Yeah. I think I can walk through that. Maybe AJ, do you want to jump in?
Yeah. So I wonder, Doug, you mentioned the Washington Post, not too long ago that they had quoted you on something. I didn't, read that article or see that. So what are some of the things that they have, quoted you on? Like, I know you saw internet events happen. So just give us a quick synopsis of what were some of those events and then how is it you're able to see those things? What technologies are you using to identify and see that stuff happening?
Let's see. As far as getting quoted, I mean, I don't know how many times I've been in the Washington Post. I had a pretty good rapport there. They had actually sent, once we got going, back in dying days, they actually sent Craig Timberg, one of their lead tech reporters, to spend a day with me in Hanover, New Hampshire. And then we've had a collaborative relationship since then. In fact, this is a good BGP story. I took to Craig and to that in 2021, so just a couple of years ago. You guys may recall this. I'm sure it popped up at some point, but on the NANOG list, people started to notice that there was some sort of entity that had nobody knew what it was, and all of a sudden it starts announcing more DoD. IP address space than anything that's ever existed on the internet. And people were asking, like, have anybody seen this? What is this? And are these guys like hijacking the DoD, or like, is this, should we be concerned about this thing? And then there was, someone piped up, like, oh no, it's fine, don't worry about it. And I was like, what is this thing? And so then, I started digging into it and, I don't know. Like I guess the full story is probably still kind of out there, but, what was intriguing to me was that, so it started in January 2021. And if you go back to the timing of the announcements, it was within 3 minutes of the statutory end of the Trump administration, which made it a very intriguing thing. Like, what is going on here? And, in the end, it's a company that was contracted by the Department of Defense to do data collection stuff. And this is still an ongoing thing. But Yeah, I got a lot of, we got a lot of play on that. I had contacted Craig at the Washington Post. He had Paul Son, who's now with New York Times. But at the time he was their Pentagon guy, and he was going inside the Pentagon to figure out what was going on. And then right as we were about to publish our thing, and we had a nice thing where I was going to write up a more technical thing for our for my readers. They were going to write something that a Washington Post reader would be able to understand. And we were angling in towards a date to publish. And then the AP also was working on the same story. And then they reached out to get my take on this. And I was like, all right, well, I think I'm working on the same story with another outlet. And then I mentioned to the Post guys, I was like, all right, there's another outlet that's asking me. And they're like, all right, we gotta go. We gotta publish it. So then it became this race between the two organizations. That's why both stories came out on a Saturday morning. Cause I think the Washington Post wanted to put it out on a Friday. They got bumped by something, ended up going out on the Saturday morning. And I let Frank at the AP know, like, the story's out with the Washington Post. He's like, shit. And so then he gets his story out within a couple of hours. He was almost done with it. And then he had some unique stuff. So there's two competing outlets. That was like a big story for like 24 hours. And I remember talking to Craig afterwards, and he was like, I've been doing this for 20 years. I've been a reporter at the Post, and that was the most read story I've ever done. I don't even understand why. it was the most read story on the Washington Post that weekend, according to our internal metrics. It just had the nice formula of, there's some sort of intrigue, maybe around Trump, and then like the BGP thing was very, there was a shadowy, company that's doing this, had a lot of pieces that were interesting, but, I don't know if I can. I've done a lot of different stories over the years. So I've done a lot of BGP stuff. I don't know. Just recently with what's going on in Gaza, there's a lot of questions people have about like what's the state of telecommunications there. And so even before this, I was just in a chat with a reporter, giving some updates. And again, now I've got NetFlow to play with, where. I never had that before. As a guy who is a BGP analyst, BGPR is basically, these are potential paths that traffic could take from one place to another, but I don't know that any packets went there, and so we would see, I might see a really, suspicious BGP hijack. Did anything actually follow that path? I don't know. But maybe it did. With NetFlow, I actually have records of traffic. And the way I'm able to use that, so our customers, we have some people for one reason or another, either because they're just such a huge backbone carrier, there's no way we could ingest the flow kind of thing, or they're in a country where there's data sovereignty rules that prevent them from sending by law NetFlow out of the country kind of thing. Most everybody else, they do a cloud-based service, and it's better for everybody because then, we can do this in mass. They don't have to maintain servers to do the data collection and processing. But then with that, there's a data use agreement, and I can use this according to that agreement. I've got some rules of the road of like what I can and can't do, and so it has to be done in aggregate. So I'm not, outing any individual customer. When I'm looking at Gaza, it doesn't really matter which of our 350 customers this flow record came from. That's not the side that I'm looking at. I'm looking at the other side. And so if a country goes offline and we see the traffic dry up to zero, it works fine because that's not the side of the record that I'm interested in. But it is fascinating though. So we can dig into BGP even more nuanced things of like a leak. So someone's screwed up BGP. They're supposed to be announced. They're announcing, let's say they announced all the routes they learned from one transit provider. They just announced out to another transit provider. And now there's this loop going through their network. And it's slowing down traffic, or traffic's getting dropped or misdirected. Again, in the past, we could either see that in BGP, estimate or guess that some traffic was probably impacted by that, or we were running a lot of trace routes back then, and some of them would get sucked in, and we could follow, look at the trace route impact. But now I could just pull up the NetFlow again because we're annotating all the records with full AS paths and source and destination. Then I can just make a query and say, all right, did I see any across our customers, did we see any traffic that followed this AS subsequence that that captures the leak? And sure enough, I can see it. And then I can even see things like, well, of the traffic that should have gone in that direction, how much like dropped off, like how much was lost because it's going in such a path that it's getting disconnected. And so that's another impact. Either traffic gets misdirected or traffic gets get dropped because it's trying to go too far. Something's congested or the latency's too high or something. It's neat to be able to see a B2B event and then pull it up in NetFlow and see, those two impacts because I never used to be able to see that. I just, intellectually would kind of know it should happen something along these lines, but, anyway,
how are you getting the NetFlow? Because like Gaza is an example. If somebody asked you, what's the internet look like as a result of what's happening there? I mean, you have to be collecting everything all the time for a baseline, right?
So we have a lot of content providers. We have telecommunications companies. So, gaming, whatever. There's all kinds of companies that are using our stuff. And,
so they're your customers. They're paired with you sending all their stuff. Okay.
Yeah.
That's the secret sauce that I'm missing, right? So peer review, you see all their stuff. Okay.
Yeah. There's I guess I'm not the best person to explain the various options, but we've got a few ways. Either you send it over the internet or we have a direct connect with you somewhere, or there's depending on a bunch of conditions, we've got some way that we can go and capture that. And then, we peer with you. We got ways we can pull in all the data we need.
So I guess you have different ways with unfriendly countries. I'm thinking of like Russia, let's say, with the Ukraine stuff. Like if you were trying to see it, didn't something happen with BGP? Didn't Russia try to do something with Ukraine's?
I mean, that there could be a couple answers to that, but I think I know the one you're talking about. So let's see. When we're looking at a country that like Russia or Cuba or a country, we're not going to have any customers in. So we're really just looking at the outside in, which for a lot of these places, that's fine because that's most of the traffic, right? They're not the source of traffic. They're the destination of traffic. So the fact that I've got that side of it, I'm happy. There's not any meaningful amount of traffic coming, at least some of these places. So in the case of Russia, there's been any number of BGP things, but I think as far as you mentioned Ukraine, the story I did last year with the New York Times was around what took place in Kherson. So there's a city in the south that now has been partially reclaimed based on a counteroffensive by the Ukrainians about a year ago. During the course of 2022, as that city was taken over by Russia, the Russian military came in and at gunpoint had the network engineers reconnect their lines down through Crimea, which they had taken over in 2014, and then on over to Russia over either the bridge or the submarine cable in the Kerch Strait. And so that meant that all the internet communications for the city of Kherson then had to go through Russian carriers, would be subject to any kind of surveillance, manipulation of that traffic. So that took place where they cut it over. And then after the offensive, about half or more, a little more than half of those providers then switched back to Ukrainian transit, depending on where they lie geographically. There's a river that splits the city, and the Russians have the south still, and the Ukrainians have the north. So,
Was there one place in Ukraine? Another thing I'm trying to get my head around is, the way BGP works in the internet, right? Like there's just so much, there's so many connections and so much resiliency to go around things. Like there's just one building you can walk into Ukraine and just all the traffic in Ukraine goes through that building and they just send it to Russia. I mean, that's another simplification.
I guess there probably was a choke point in this case. There definitely was a network that was working on behalf of the Russian government in Crimea. And so that was, back in 2014. I've been doing this for a while, so I was covering that stuff as well. The fall of 2013 with the Maidan protests, and then it was months after that in the spring that the Russians had the little green men guys without any insignia on just show up with guns, and it was the Russian special forces taking over Crimea, and then they had a vote that they kind of ran at gunpoint to say, hey, where do you want to be? You want to be part of Russia? Now you're Russia. And then Medvedev, which was prime minister at the time, I think, came down and gave a speech. All right, Crimea is ours. And then among his orders of the day were all the telecommunications can no longer go through a foreign government. It has to go through us. And so they created this outfit, Miranda Media, which is an extension of the state telecom, of Rostelecom, that would be the new transit carrier for that region, and everything would then get routed out through mainland Russia. So then when Kherson,
that sounds like surveillance, right? Like they wanted to see.
Yeah. I mean, they want to have the ability to tap into any of the internet communications. They want it all to go through their own stuff. I'm sure there's both interception, and then also you probably can do stuff of identifying if you've got, you're trying to identify some dissidents or some sort of rebels, and something about where they're connecting to, then you can try to trace back where are they in this, who are they getting service from. So you need to have all the traffic to be able to do that kind of thing. And so I think we can assume, when they take it over, that the risk, gets high for people who are, still using the internet and are trying to resist the Russian occupation. So
I know we've been going a while, and I don't want to run out of time and not get to touch this. But it didn't seem like it happened in the Russia scenario. But the government shutdowns, right? Like you mentioned, Arab Springs, and I think that was the first one you got pulled into. So I guess one of the things that I'm fascinated—it's not the right word—but kind of amazed by is that a government can just shut down internet connectivity to all of its citizens. I guess I'm fortunate enough to live where I live, right? And like that doesn't happen here. And I wouldn't think that our government could shut our internet down.
Yeah, I know.
Doesn't seem like within the realm of possibility because of the technical way I know how BGP works. It would have to be, like you said, a choke point. Like there'd have to be one or two centralized places that you could
off. Yes and no. I guess I think the United States is, it would be from a practical standpoint, really challenging to shut the internet off. It would be really hard to pull it off. But I would say that, for a little while, I think, so the Arab Spring, Egypt was January 2011. There were a bunch of shutdowns subsequent to that, and then it became kind of a thing. And it was a lot of discussion of like, oh, how do we push back on this? How do we keep the internet on? And Jim Cowie, I mentioned earlier, founders of Renesas, had written a pretty good blog of like, oh, could it happen in your country? And he did a little back of the envelope analysis of how many international connections does a country have, and if it just goes through one carrier, then they would be more at risk because they just have one place to turn it all off. There's a choke point. But if you had lots of connections out, then maybe you'd be more resilient. And unfortunately, that has not held true. And what ends up happening in other countries is that even if there isn't a technical choke point, there is a legal authoritative choke point in the sovereign government of that country. And so for every country, there is a telecom regulator that is the one that provides licenses for the telecoms to operate. You, me, and we cannot go into country X and start providing telecommunications services. We have to have a license from the government to do that. And if we go awry of what the government wants us to do, then they can pull that. And so what we've seen in some of these places that have maybe some more diverse connectivity is that the government just contacts all the providers they have on the list. They have a list of who they've given licenses to. So you want to keep your license, you want to keep your investment in the country, then you're going to do what we say, and we want to turn things off. And so it no longer becomes a technical thing, and it becomes more of a administrative thing. And in the case of Myanmar, I had some contacts there. One of the providers received this over fax, which I think is kind of I don't know why that's kind of humorous, but they got their short shutdown orders over fax that they had to by 10 p.m. that night turn off the internet. And so it doesn't.
I hadn't thought of licensing. Like the FCC here licenses everything and could conceivably threaten to pull your license.
Yeah,
I'm not trying to say it's going to happen here and here's how
right.
You would,
it's still pretty hard to imagine. Yeah, but in these other countries, you can imagine you've got a multinational like MTN out of South Africa has got subsidiaries all over Africa. It takes some money to put those in. If the country, the government says they have to shut it off or you lose your license, where they have to make a business decision. And at the end of the day, they comply. Because what are they supposed to do? So it's a very difficult situation. And sometimes they, I guess the best thing that that some of these companies have, best way to, it's pretty weak, but the way to push back is just to be publicize that, to make sure everyone knows, hey, we were legally ordered to do this. We live in a Westphalian world, so every country has a sovereign government that is kind of has a somewhat absolute power over its country, and we don't have a way to override that. And if they do something bad, that is a reality legally.
What's your prediction that it'll happen here someday?
Oh, in the United States?
Yeah.
Again, I think from a practical standpoint, that's what's going to get us out is, they're going to, if we approach that scenario, the engineers are going to be like, man, I don't know how to do this. we have a very, one thing that saved Ukraine, that's been an ingredient to their resiliency is the fact that the way they structured their telecommunications market is that a lot of the towns had little mom and pop ISPs. And so there's all these little ISPs with all these different connections going. And so they end up being this really wonderful tapestry of connectivity that as if you took something out, there wasn't that consolidation where you could just have two companies. And if you just tell the two companies to turn it off, ended up being, so that was actually a really brilliant ingredient that I'm sure that was not, that wasn't what they were thinking when they were making
that was
it.
Ukraine, right?
Yeah, Ukraine. So, like,
and then there was a Starlink component too, wasn't there? Didn't they try to do some satellite?
Yeah, so Starlink became a story there too. That it got a little bit overstated as far as what was Starlink doing for Ukraine. So we would see, again, this is like spring last year after Elon Musk said we're going to send Starlink devices in and provide service there. Then there was like headlines like Starlink is keeping the Ukraine connected to the internet. And like, that's not true. It's not to say that they weren't doing something super important and valuable. Certainly for somebody who did tactical comm in the military, I get why a small, a movable satellite connection that you could take with you through the field, that would be incredibly valuable to maintain communications. But the main lines that was keeping the connection up were the fiber lines going out to the west that sometimes they got broke, they got blown up by airstrikes, and to the credit of the engineers there, the guy, our equivalents in Ukraine were driving into bombed out central offices and rewiring. They're still doing that. This is an ongoing thing. These guys are at great risk to themselves going into these areas to restore service and splice fiber in a smoking hole. So that's what it takes. But it is super important. It is really. Again, for something that maybe the three of us, we haven't experienced this. I hope we never do. But if you are in a situation like that, like kind of a dangerous war type situation, you've got loved ones that you would like to either contact or let them know you're okay or find out if they're okay. If you're cut off from all communications for an extended period of time, it is a traumatic thing, even just that. That you need, I remember having this conversation with, I've got a lot of contacts in Ukraine of saying like, well, internet maybe isn't the biggest thing. Like that just because you can't, surf the internet. And you're like, no, you don't understand. Like if you can't reach your family members, and you don't know if they're alive or dead, and it takes days to find out that you're that's not a very pleasant situation to be in. And it's, you know,
yeah, that's awful. It seems nowhere near what they're experiencing there, but like one or two small natural disasters that have happened around where I live, like, you know, a minor earthquake, for an example, happened like 10 or 11 years ago, very minor. All the phone systems stopped working because everybody tried to call everybody at once, and you can't, it just, the switches get overwhelmed. It's not,
sure.
It's not built to take that kind of. So, you know, my wife now, but girlfriend at the time, you know, I'm a cable guy on poles. She's at, you know, some corporate building, and their whole building shakes, and she's like, oh my God, my boyfriend works on telephone poles. Like, I have to see if he's okay. And we couldn't reach each other for about 20 minutes. Again, not a war zone. I'm not trying to draw that parallel, but just that 20 minutes of not being able to reach a loved one, not sure what happened and if they're okay. I can't imagine that.
Yeah. So that's the value of communication is, you know, I think we kind of trivialize it because we do a lot of trivia. We're like cat videos and we do silly stuff, but like it comes down to it. We all have loved ones that we need to reach out to in a tough situation. And if you can't, it's very stressful.
Those are huge. I wrote down a quick list of like types and causes of internet outages, like human error, right? Like rat leaks, fat fingering stuff, physical damage, undersea cables, you know, government shutdowns, BGP hijacking. I mean, at everything you watch, like, is there like a number one cause of people breaking BGP on the internet? Like, is it humans doing dumb stuff, or is it just varied and sundried?
I'm not sure how I'd rank those. Yeah, like within the category of like submarine cable stuff, like I've done a lot of that analysis of that, you know, that's definitely an anchor. Like it's a human related, someone either dropping an anchor and dragging it, or dropping they do a lot of trolling, like they drop a net for fishing and drag the net along to just scoop up all the life, kind of kills everything. And then they pick out the fish they want, kill everything else. Those things snag cables. It's definitely humans cause most submarine cable cuts.
Do they break often, submarine cables?
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple breaks every week, but I mean, it's a global infrastructure and there's a system for repair and, I don't know. There's always like a conversation of how much, if any, you know, threat of submarine cable sabotage is there. Has this happened? There's been a couple cases where it has, but I know, well, maybe 10 years ago when people started talking about like, oh, like the Russians could, you know, cut all the cables and cut us off. Yeah, we take a lot of cables to really make a dent in, at least for U.S. connectivities. Other countries, you know, there are places that rely on a single cable.
I'm looking at a map. It's amazing. Like just submarine.
It is an endlessly fascinating topic. I had the pleasure of presenting at a handful of conferences. Cause that was actually, I ran this going back to that, the story when I started, you know, we would get inquiries from customers kind of like, you know, like, okay, could you figure out some submarine cable stuff? Like, can you see it in your data and the BGP stuff? And so that kind of got handed down to me, like, hey, work on this, see if you can figure out how do you find submarine cable events, either activations or outages in our data. So then I would go and just start reading the headlines and reading the, you know, what are people saying is happening, and then try to see, can I find it in the data? And that led to, you know, a practice of spotting submarine cable activations. And then within the submarine cable community, like, people know that that's kind of something I do. So the last couple people have kind of given me a tip. They're like, hey, you know, like, we know this cable's coming active. You're the guy who usually writes a story about this. So the latest one was last month in St. Helena, an island in the South Atlantic, just got a submarine cable activation. The cable had landed months earlier, but we just started passing traffic, and it's kind of amazing. And so I felt
how
like
how do you that, know, like, you're just it's ridiculous what you know. How do you know that a new submarine cable is laid, lit up, and passing traffic? Like, I mean, this is probably your secret sauce. You can't tell me, but like,
No, not at all, not at all. Again, if you get to know the subject, you know, there's a few places where cables, like, there isn't a cable and they're trying to get a cable there. Like, okay, well, there's an island nation somewhere and the cable's coming someday. Like, all right, fine. Like, you'd want to set up something. Like, for St. Helena, I knew this was coming at some point. And so months and months ago, I set up tests out of our Kentik, like our performance monitoring. I started finding IPs that would respond to me, respond to our agents around the world, located in St. Helena, run those tests, do a trace route. Like, okay, we're going over a satellite link. All right, one day I'll come back. And I'll see the transition, and it's really dramatic. From from a latency standpoint, right. I'm not just doing anything latency, to test capacity, but that capacity would probably be a bigger change. But so then I kind of got to know just what are the stories. So then, you know, when I was first getting into that, I stumbled upon a blog about the internet in Cuba, and at the time. Was still exclusively connected through geostationary satellite. They had a couple of different providers. There's one telecom, a state telecom, still this way. There's one, Texas, a state telecom for Cuba. And they had been, due to the U.S. embargo, all the submarine cables that were laid in the Caribbean are, they all go around Cuba. Then nobody lands there, and nobody wants to mess with the embargo because it can be fairly punitive, even for non-U.S. entities. And so it was the Venezuelan government, although I don't know, someone told me recently they thought the Chinese chipped in. I don't know. Whoever paid for it, they built a submarine cable between Cuba and Venezuela. And then this was constructed finished in 2011. And by 2013, the country was still on geostationary satellite. And I came across this blog of this guy writing about this. He's a professor out in California, who had an interesting internet in developing places. And, got to know the story. I was like, all right, well, I had made him some graphs. Like I wrote him an email. I was like, maybe the cable's up and there's some, we just don't know how to see it. Does anybody know? And he was kind of writing out to the world. And I've got data. We can see that it's all satellite providers. And I was like, I'll do this for you. I'll set up a little thing in our stuff. And if we see a new BGP connection, for a Texan Cuba, I'll get a little email to myself and I'll know. So I'll let you know if I see anything new pop up. So I wrote something, and it was like 18 months later that I got that email. So it took a long time. And then, I got this email like, oh, Telefonica is now there's now an adjacency between Telefonica and, or Telxius now, and Atexa. Like, all right, well, that alone doesn't mean anything. That could still be a, maybe they subcontract out for a satellite link. And so then we had trace routes running from servers around the world going to everything, every part of the world. And so we could pull through time or with trace routes going into Cuba, and you could see that transition from geostationary satellite to submarine cable. And it's a pretty stark difference. And so we broke that story, and I got a lot of press for that. And then I've done a bunch of cables since then, and the most recent one was the one in St. Helena. Again, I used to present at submarine cable conferences about this. And at those conferences in the submarine cable industry, the people who attend them are people who are either the fabrication people to actually make the cable, fiber optics experts, presenting what's the latest technology that can push even more bits through a strand of glass. They're the installers, and those are the people who drive the ships and feed the cable out the water. So these are ship captains or ship crew and financiers, but there's not really computer scientists that typically show up at these things. So I was a bit of a novelty for a while going to these, and I'd be like, I'd show, like, here's this cable cut, and here's what it looked like, here's what happened. And they were like, how do you know? Like, cable operators don't publicize this. In fact, it's notoriously secretive. And I was like, well,
don't you know who I am?
This is before I got that that title. That
I'm Neo. I see the Matrix.
I had a very funny interaction for a little while. I was definitely trying to catch every submarine cable, this or that, activation break, what were the impacts. And at one point, there was a LinkedIn group that's a really good link. There's a lot of all the people in the submarine cable space are in this LinkedIn group. And I used to publish this, and I got pushback. I would get this from a couple of people. And one guy wrote to me, and he's like, there's an NDA that's signed between the cable operator and the telecom that's buying the bandwidth that they're not to publicize this because the cable operators don't want a lot of, they don't want all the bad news about cable breaks. And it happens to them all, but they just, since they're all secretive, they all have to stay secretive. And he's like, so there's this NDA, and you, by writing your analysis, are violating the spirit of the NDA that they signed. And I was like, man, I was like, that's amazing. I was like, I'm not changing anything, but it's just amazing that someone thinks I have to comply with a NDA that's not even related. I didn't sign this. And this is, I look at our data, like the BGP stuff, this is essentially public data. This is a public event. So I'm not really going to change them, but I just found that so fascinating that mentality exists in that industry.
Last question. Crazy. You ready?
But, yeah, sure.
All right. So you can see the internet. So
can't unsee it.
Some things I wish I could unsee. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, you know, what does the future of the internet look like from your perspective? And honestly, as we were talking, I looked up, so I'm going to make it simple for you, right? And go as complicated as you want, but I'm looking at, there's 65% of the world's population has internet access. Hmm. Now, you know, whether that's accurate or not, I don't know. Google never lies. I Googled like 3 or 4 times. So, you know, there's a hell of a lot of people that don't even have access to the internet, you know, on the planet today. So I guess in my utopian world, after we just spent an hour talking about how much the internet, you know, communications in general can like enable humans, I guess what I'd love to see, if you asked me, would be, you know, internet access for everybody. But I know it's expensive, right? Like, I don't know who pays for all those undersea cables, and they're, you know, we're putting rockets in space for satellites. I mean, it's expensive to get access. So I guess it's a financial thing, but you know, this is the first time I've ever asked a guest a question and then answered it myself, which is I'd like to see internet access for everybody. But let me get back to the question to you. I mean, do you have any insight into what the future holds? You know, you're the guy who sees it all.
I don't.
What would you like to see it? Like, do you have any idea where we're headed with all this?
Yeah, I guess I see a lot of progress. I mean, I write about routing security, and I just have been giving some talks recently. I wrote something up as a little history of big BGP incidents. I've given this talk a couple times of just what, as someone who's covered it for the last 13 years, what I think are the main incidents. And I would say that space has gotten better, I think. And we've made progress there. And so as an engineering community, we should take a moment and say, hey, like a lot of people worked on this. It wasn't just people. There's a lot of people, a lot of companies did a lot of things. And we're in a better place now. We don't have these fat finger, origination leaks that take out the internet. They were like, the last one was maybe 2019. I don't know. There's a reason why they haven't happened for a few years, and that's great. So that, but then in the BGP space, we still have this issue of determined adversary, of someone who understands the weaknesses, is sophisticated, and can get around like RPKI, ROV, and other security mechanisms we've built. And so it's progress that we can now having dealt with some of these bonehead errors, made the internet more resilient to those, that we can focus on, like, how do we shore up? Because there are still a lot of weaknesses there, that we really haven't addressed very well. So, what's the future? I hope we continue, to keep kind of moving the needle and making that, raising the bar on what a determined adversary has to do to pull off an attack that involves a BGP hijack. Or DNS hijack. So, as far as the topic of the other 3 billion people that don't have internet access, I mean, it's possible that these LEO, low Earth orbit constellations can help to democratize internet. So that includes Starlink and OneWeb, and we'll see if Project Kuiper gets off the ground. But it's unclear. I mean, it's even unclear. Starlink has the huge benefit of having their own, you have SpaceX. So the fact that they can launch their own, it's the same company or pretty much can launch stuff into space, is just a huge, huge advantage to that as a internet service provider, whereas these other companies have to contract out someone to launch, and they don't control it. And will Starlink be transformational in that? I hope so. And if it's not them, I hope it's somebody else. But yeah, it's very hard to participate in modern society without an internet connection. And there's still a lot of people who don't have it. So that's something we as a human race have to work on right now.
Ooh, Doug, this has been a fun conversation. The entire time you were talking, I was Googling and adding links to notes. And so the show notes on this one is going to be really, really good.
All right. Oh man, for people who know me, you just don't want to get me started because I will talk for like 6 hours. I have so many good stories.
Yeah, you do. Some of the stuff that you've written about is extremely fascinating.
I thought of writing a book because there's always like a background. Like I've got sources in places. I had a source inside Syrian Telecom giving me information out the back before he fled the country. I mean, just like some really good. Just, you know, when you start writing this stuff, people reach out to you and they want to either correct the record or tell the, you know, fill out the story or, so then, it ended up being kind of a snowball effect where the more you do, the more people come to you and then they ask you better questions or they give you more insight and then your product becomes better. I get that, both on the more technical BGP analysis side, and then also the geopolitical stuff of I've got contacts in Gaza, although one of them I haven't heard from last week, so I hope he's okay. But folks trying to tell me from the inside what's going on, and there's a lot of I look at that as those are our people, right? Those are our network engineers doing kind of what we do, but under completely different circumstances, right. And I find that. I feel a little bit of a duty to tell the story of, especially like we talked about Ukraine, of those guys going out and repairing lines that have recently been bombed to help their country. That's an act of patriotism, and there's people all over the world that do stuff like that. But just doing the same things that you and I, our people in our audience do, but doing it in a much more dangerous situation because communications is just that important.
You know, when you go on social media and you look at some of the crap that you look at, right, that just posted out there, it's hard to think of how critical the internet. I mean, there are days where I'm ready to walk away from the internet, but then something like this happens and you realize just how critical it has become, and especially when you want to communicate with loved ones in situations like that. So, Doug, thank you so much for spending time with us. Where can people find more about you, the stories that you post, LinkedIn, Twitter, where are you active?
Yeah, so let's see. I publish on our Karkentic blog. We have I publish most of the stuff. If I write something up, it's there. Otherwise, I'm on Twitter, and LinkedIn are probably the places to find me. We'll see where the dust settles on the Twitter right. Thing. But definitely, we're technologists, we're professionals, so it's definitely going in. A lot of that stuff ends up showing up in LinkedIn. So shoot me if you can find me on LinkedIn, shoot me an invite. And I usually accept anybody who's in the industry because I like to talk to people in different parts of our industry.
Awesome. I have found your Twitter, your LinkedIn, and some of the blog posts that you've written on Kentik, specifically ones that we were talking about here during the show, as few okay. as some of the posts from, was it Washington Post? A couple of the Washington Post articles as well. Even the one in 2014 that named you the man who can see the internet. That was a pretty cool article.
You know, I didn't use that for a couple of years. After that, I was like, that's super flattering. It's a little over the top. I was at an event in Europe. We were with Dyn at the time. Renesas had been acquired. We were Dyn DNS, and our head of sales for Europe was with me, and he was like, "How are you not using that?" And I was like, "That's too much, man. I can't say that." And I'm not a it's very not fitting for me. It's very uncomfortable for me to say something like that. And then he's like, don't do it for you. Do it for me. I'm trying to make sales. Like it makes my job easier if you use that. So, he's like, look at the rest of the people who would benefit if you would just do that. And I was like, all right, I guess. So I always feel like I have to share it. Like I'm doing this for my team. We all benefit from that. I hope.
That's a hell of a moniker. If somebody said something like that about me, I'd have a cape with it on the back. Just walking around like Macho Man Savage. Woo!
I need to have that etched on a tombstone, ready to go. Here lies.
That's great. Well, again, Doug, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And we'll see you next time on another episode of the Arts of Network Engineering podcast. Hey, everyone, this is AJ. If you like what you heard today, then make sure you subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcatcher. Smash that bell icon to get notified of all of our future episodes. Also, follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We are at Art of Net Eng. That's Art of N-E-T-E-N-G. You can also find us on the web at artofnetworkengineering.com, where we post all of our show notes. You can read blog articles from the co-hosts and guests, and also a lot more news and info from the networking world. Thanks for listening.